Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
There's a poem in the memoir called The Want List. And the first phrase is, I don't want to miss my mother. And I guess I've wondered if you've come to terms with wanting to miss her, not just missing her. It's clear you miss her, but wanting to miss her.
I mean, the whole summer with the tour, I've been writing, and I've been writing, and since I stopped the tour, I've been pondering the meaning of all this, pondering the meaning of the things I already wrote, and coming to the realization that my difficulties with my mother are also my difficulties with my tribe, my difficulties with my country, my difficulties with the Native American world in general. But really, at the heart of it is my difficulties with those things I share with my mother. So in examining my mother and thinking about my mother and who she was in good and bad ways, I've come to understand that I share most of her bad qualities and very few of her good ones. So I think in saying...
Do you think that's objectively true, or is that just what you believe about yourself?
Well, there is no trail of destruction behind me in my life. You're going to have a hard time finding enemies of mine. You'll find strangers who hate me, but you won't find people who know me who hate me, except one. But
who?
Well, love is love. And and maybe not even now anymore. That's been decades. So I think I've managed my monstrous qualities better than my mother did. So in writing, I don't miss my mother. I don't want to miss my mother. I mean, every book is a mirror. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I write about my mom in the book, and I explicitly say it, but there's an implicit thing to it too. Like, there's when I explicitly say in the book, oh, I'm this part of my mom and this part of my mom, that's easy to say. But there's the notion that every word in there is really about me. And it's pretty difficult to ponder the monster in yourself. And I'm alive. I've survived. I've have this career, and a lot of it has to do with being good at things and being a good person, but a lot of it has to do with being an arrogant cannibal, too. So I am my mother's son.
But so I asked you if you thought it was objectively true that really that the equation is you're a lot of bad things about her and you're very few good things about her.
Yeah.
It sounds like pain speaking and not.
Well, how about this? It's a good question. I'm going to owe you $90.
I'll take it. Why 90?
I think my contentious relationship with my mother, my equally angry and hateful reaction to her anger and hate, mm-hmm. prevented me from seeing the value of her good parts. And maybe that has formed me into somebody who has a hard time seeing what's good about myself. And maybe part of the grieving process is coming to the realization that maybe I do share more of those qualities about her that are good.
The good qualities.
I believe.
Right. What do you think was the best thing about her?
That's right off the top of my head. She was so funny. So. I right there, I can make whole rooms laugh with an eyebrow.
Right. You're fun.
I can move my hand. And
you possess that quality.
Yeah, but I didn't always. I mean, I think maybe the thing I don't have and didn't have, for all sorts of reasons, is that maybe you can talk about this just in terms of my generation of Native Americans, is we are the children of the boarding school. We are the children of the frontline soldiers in the genocide against Native Americans. I mean, I'm only 2 degrees removed from Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, who was a babysitter for my grandmother when she was a toddler. So I think in many ways it's my generation that lived in the aftermath of the Native American apocalypse. They had everything taken from them. Our parents' generation and our grandparents' generation had everything mm-hmm. stolen from them, who were battered and violated, and we were raised by them. And, I mean, it's astonishing their strength and power that they survived that, and so many of us are here and surviving and thriving, but there's still so much pain involved in that, so much trauma, that there's a disconnect from culture and language and ceremony. And I think my mother's direct connection to the culture, my mother's direct connection to the language, I mean, the Spokane language is being taught again, and they're reviving it, but it's a new way of speaking Spokane. And when an elder dies, words go with them, concepts go with them, a cosmology disappears. So my mother's part of the tribal cosmology is gone. She had that. I mean, the image that just popped in my head is, I mean, my mother, it's funny, I got rushing nesting dolls in my head.
Just now?
Just now, rushing nesting dolls popped into my head, and it's not because my last name is Alexi, but I just saw this idea of these generations of people nesting together. And my mom, in many, many ways, was the last person in my family to be born in that nest, to live her whole life in that nest.
Mm-hmm.
And her children, my siblings and I, were kind of forced out of that nest. And we grew up emerging from broken shells, broken eggs. And we've had to reinvent, recreate, renew, and try to find our way to connect as best as we can with what was taken. So despite my mother's pain and the trauma she went through and everything bad and terrible that happened to her and everything she did herself, she was still in the nest. And I don't have that. I'm from the broken egg.
I was listening to an interview years ago with the late playwright Sam Shepard, and it got replayed when he died recently, and he was talking about being raised by a family where there was a lot of pain and trauma. They didn't have much, and with a very controlling father who loomed large in his life for much of his life. And Shepard said this: "It's very difficult to escape your background. I don't think it's necessary to even try to escape it. More and more, I start to think that it's necessary to see exactly what it is that you inherited on both sides of the stick. Your timidity, your courage, your self-deceit, and your honesty. It's brave, isn't it?
I love that guy.
I know.
And he's the reason why I keep trying to write terrible plays. I've never, really. I've written many and they're all bad and nobody's ever seen them. But Buried Child, I just, there is this idea that Native Americans have a special kind of pain. But really, everybody's pain has the same value, mm-hmm. has the same quality.
Right.
And I often get accused by natives and non-natives of dealing in stereotypes because I write about my pain. And I would say to any native listening or any native writers who have ambitions about having a writing career that they have no idea why somebody is going to read your work or how they're going to respond to it. That you can't guess at what inside your work as an Indian is going to appeal to a non-Indian. And that what has happened for me over the decades now is that non-Indians don't come up to me, well, sometimes they still do, and say goofy things about spirituality or teepees. or I mean, just a couple months ago, a smart woman I've known for years came up to me and said, I just read that before Columbus Indians only talked in monotone. and I looked at her and it's like, I felt so betrayed. I had no idea you were such a liberal racist. And then I just said, go away. And it was at a big fundraiser, and she's fairly prominent. And I'm like, go away and never speak to me again. You hear what this is? This is anger. This is not monotone. This is my voice trembling. Go away.
Back to Sam Shepard.
So... on this tour in particular with this book and about my difficult relationship with my mother, what has happened, and I feel angry now and I feel frustrated and sad. I mean, there's natives in the room, a few of you. There's those of you who are native by proxy or osmosis or because you're married to somebody or you know how self-destructive we can be. You know the gossip culture. The negativity in our world. And it makes me sad that all these native artists are suspicious of or don't want or don't realize or the humanity of people, of non-natives who come up to you because they've read your book, not because of some stereotypical reason. They've read your book because it speaks to them on some cellular level. And I've heard people tell me so many amazing little stories about their relationship with their mothers. And I've gotten so many letters and so many emails. About growing up with a mom like mine.
Mm-hmm.
So while some natives might feel like I've betrayed something, that I haven't lived up to some political ideal or some cultural norm, what has happened because of this book and my other books is that thousands of people feel validated. And I've gotten those letters from other Indians too.
So you have been doing what Shepard is talking about, which is not escaping it, but turning back to acknowledge the timidity, the self-deceit, the courage, the strength.
In the hurricane of my life, I'm the idiot who just tied himself to his front porch.
Still?
Yep.
Still.
I'm still there. Got my iPad.
You know. Watching where that yep. thing's going to land.
Yeah. Yep.
All right.
On the Weather Channel.
Right.
Three of them. And I'll keep doing this. I mean, the joke is, as you know, that I feel afraid of writing now. So a lot of what I'm writing now is removed a bit. I had a story in the New Yorker this summer about a white motel maid. Wow. I have another story coming in the New Yorker, 2 in 1 year. Woo! And I've got 2 houses in Cheeverville. It's a complicated joke. And no Indian has ever made that joke. That's how crazy my life is. Oh, my God. And, I mean, you know what I'm jealous of? And it's also for all sorts of cultural, economic, social, racist reasons, all sorts of pressures and weirdness. And I get blamed for things that aren't my fault. But I'm the only Indian dude with this career. And Louise Erdrich is the only Indian woman with that career. And we don't have, like, the gender ally. Like, I don't have another Indian dude. Like, I don't have the res Indian dude. I can text from some ridiculous New Yorker party I was just at and say, dude, 'cause you won't believe these pretentious dickwads. I mean, I have a lot of white working class writer friends who I can text.
Who would all get it.
Yeah, but there's right? other stuff, like they're all white guys, and I love them. Jess Walter, one of my best friends, is a white working class dude. At one point in our youth, we lived 12 miles apart. We didn't know each other, but we lived 12 miles apart, so we're from the same, I mean, we had the same area code. I mean, not just the same area code, we had the second number. I don't know, what is that called? We had the same area code and then the next 3 numbers. What is that called? Exchange?
That wow. was a rhetorical question, wow. I think.
And so, no, it wasn't. I didn't know.
I wish know. It was. What?
And so I can text him. I can talk to him about this, but there's... And maybe on this, I think perhaps because this book was so personal and being on the road with it and the loneliness of being the Indian dude wandering the earth. I mean, it's not like I'm turning to Jonathan Franzen for emotional support.
Do you remember how Jonathan Franzen came up the last time we were doing this?
He always comes up.
Somehow. Poor Jonathan Franzen.
And I like John. But.
Oh, no.
I mean, no, I'm just saying they all have friends. They all went to the same schools. They went to all the MFAs together. They teach together. They go to the same conferences together. They go to Yaddo together. You know, I'm not a part of that. So,
by choice,
90% by choice.
I'm sure Yada would be happy to have you. That's not how you want to spend your time,
right? I'd be on my iPad I'd be binge watching 30 Rock because it's going off Netflix. That's not how I work. See, that's not even how I work.
Right.
I don't wander off, you know, into some bread and breakfast in a really white part of the country to have somebody cook for me while I create my precious little fiction. That just feels... It feels like it's false. So I wandered around this book trying to be true and honest, and the artifice of a literary career was adding to the pain. And that, I mean, certainly I had the support of my friends and my wife, who's Native, and my sons. And I'm not complaining necessarily, because my life is awesome. Let's get that out of the way.
Let's.
It's awesome. Mm. It's ridiculous how cool my life is. But there is still, in the creation of the art, is where you're mining all the pain. So all the trappings of this life are great. All the things the art has given me are great. But the creation of the art remains as painful and tortured as it ever was. It hurts as much as it did when I was a 19-year-old starving in college. It hurts as much to talk about it now in a full theater as it did when there were 12 people in Hungry Mind Bookstore, you know, in 1993. And it's that gap between, it's in those gaps where the loneliness is, where the sadness is. I mean, it's that tricky thing where the solitude to create art becomes lonesomeness. Mm-hmm. And you're always in that mix, and then being the Indian dude. Ugh. It's like, oh, please. And the thing is, Indians get mad at me. I want you Indian writers to become stars. You young, if you're in here, I want you to become a giant star. I want your career to eclipse mine. I want you to sell a bajillion copies. I want you to win all the National Book Awards so I don't have to answer all the damn questions anymore.
Sometimes when I hear you say that, I wonder if that's really true.
It's increasingly true.
It's a powerful thing to be the guy that can articulate a perspective that people turn to and trust. And you know what I'm saying?
It sounds a lot better from the outside. And the thing is, it's even hard to tell people this. And I don't even know why I'm doing it. The thing is, even being honest about this stuff will just get me more hate mail. Being publicly vulnerable. There are 500 and some tribes in the U.S., another hundreds more in Canada. There are hundreds of Native writers, hundreds of perspectives, hundreds of aesthetics, hundreds of philosophies, spiritual notions, ideas. And because of economics and class and racism and conservatism and liberalism and all these isms, only a few of us are let in the door at any one time. And 25 years ago, the door opened. And I was supposed to get replaced. I was. And that's how it works. Right now you look at the National Book Award long list for poetry. Frank Bedard's on there. There's a couple, there's a Laura I don't know how to pronounce their last name. There's three old school poets, but there's seven on there. It's like, I think there's five first books. It's like, yes. It's supposed to evolve. I'm supposed to be some old, jaded professor moldering in some sad-ass little white college in Iowa.
I don't think... Somehow, I think you would make sure that that didn't happen.
I didn't mean to stay relevant.
Right.
So now you see why I stopped the tour? You know, you lay in bed at night after your thing, and you get up on stage and you try to be as honest as possible, and it's still a performance. There's still an artifice to it. So you try to be as honest as possible. You try to be as real as possible in the moment. And then you go back to your hotel room, and then you have that Brené Brown has the phrase. She coined the perfect phrase. It's like I watch her TED Talk once a week. I do. The vulnerability hangover. So, oh, that's my Indian name.
Oh my God.
So,
And is the hangover...
Usually it's afterward, like when you everything's calmed down and you're alone in your room and you're pondering everything is when it comes. But on this tour, it's been happening in real time. Like, it's like I'm drunk and have the hangover at the same time. So, like, right now,
does
in the moment.
Does it feel like that now?
Right now, I feel like an anatomy model. And that all my mental illnesses are also visible. It's like, there's my spleen, there's my heart, there's my lungs, there's my bipolarism. Like there's a professor with a laser pointer going, look at that. That's where all the good and bad comes from.
I think we have time for one excerpt. Which one would you want to read? You said okay to this.
I know.
I asked. Which one do you prefer?
The prose one.
Really?
No,
why?
Well, you've obviously displayed which one you want me to read. Somehow this feels familiar. Are we married? I'm going to get in trouble for that one.
Are you? Yeah.
Forget all the other Indians in the world.
That's right.
There's one Indian who's really going to be mad. No,
wait a minute,
not.
The want list. You just flipped by it. Do you want to do that one?
No, I'll read the poem. You wanted me to read the
that
poem.
That was the poem.
Well, find it.
This is a first. I thought you just flipped by. Okay, read this.
You're acting like I wrote the book.
I know.
I'm not even Indian. I'm Greek. Radio audience, I just put on my reading glasses. I've discovered, and they're all smeared, but I've discovered this thing that helped talking and performing about the book is that if I take off whatever glasses I have on, whether they're my reading ones or my walk-around ones, that if I blur my vision... I feel less vulnerable.
Really?
Yeah. Does anybody else experience? Yeah. So it's real. I actually have a poem about it. That blurring my vision while performing helps. So, it's some weird. The lack of physical clarity helps me with emotional clarity.
Mm-hmm.
I think it may be just a physical manifestation of the fact that I'm actually an introvert pretending to be an extrovert. And taking off the glasses helps with that.
I'm getting the feeling you don't want to read this poem.
I don't think I've performed this one either, so I think I'm a little hesitant about that.
We're here for you.
Yeah, there's nothing unhealthy about the fact that I need the validation of hundreds of total strangers. There's nothing unhealthy about my need to feed off your affection for who you think I am. I'm laughing because, you know, my wife catch, you know, when people realize she's married to me, she gets all sorts of stuff. And at one point, a fan of mine said to her, "Oh, he must be so much fun to live with."
Did she let the silence tell the story?
You know, how you have running jokes in your family. We have many in ours, of course, as well, and that's one of them. It's a tension breaker too, as when things are really tense or we're fighting or arguing over something, and one of us wants to declare peace, or call the truce, or end the tension. One of us will bring up a line like that. Yeah, you're so much fun to live with. Or, yeah, I'm so much fun to live with. I am fun to live with. Want list. I don't want to miss my mother. I don't want my want to be tangible. I don't want my tangible want to be elemental. I don't want my mother to be a baptismal fire. I don't need my mother to be clay and silt. I don't need my mother to be that basalt ridge. I don't need my mother to be that evergreen. I don't need my mother like I need the enduring earth. I don't love minor chords. I don't love every piano in the world. I don't love my stereo's choir. I don't love my mother as much as I love song-drunk air. I don't grieve everybody that I have lost. I don't grieve dammed and dammed rivers. I don't grieve my way like a salmon through the dark. I don't grieve my mother like I grieve the sacred waters. I don't grieve my mother. I don't grieve my mother. I don't grieve my mother. I don't place my mother upon that pyre. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I'm a goddamn liar.
You're listening to the opening night of our Talking Volume season at the Fitzgerald Theater, Writer Sherman Alexie is here. His new memoir is titled You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, and I'm Carrie Miller. How are you doing?
I'm okay.
Okay. I have one last thing to ask you. You ready?
Yes.
We talked about where the next generation of Native writers is coming from, and you said something about that tonight. And you said that you would tell them, your real life as an Indian is much more interesting than the Indian you think you should be. Why? Yes, I'm ending with that question.
It's a long answer.
Yeah.
When you asked that this time, what popped into my head? I was at a poetry reading a few years back, and this non-Native writer got up. And they introduced their poem. And you've all been at these readings where somebody gets up and tells this amazing story. And this poet told the story about how she was in a car wreck, a mass car wreck, in a fog, a big fog. And how, like, it was like 25 cars got into a wreck in a fog bank.
Mm-hmm.
And how they spun off into a field. And so she's telling, oh man, she's telling all these amazing details about the wreck and how scared she was in spinning, the feeling of spinning into a field, not knowing what was out there. And then she said, and for some reason, I don't know why I did it, I shouldn't have, but I got out of the car. And I walked out, and then a car emerged from the fog and was coming right at me. And it got so close, I could see the expression on the driver's face. And then that driver turned and missed me by inches.
Mm-hmm.
The car came so close, it blew my hair. So she tells a story like this, and you're all going, you're all, right, you're all like rearing back in your seats, right? Now, how powerful that is. So she tells the story, and she goes, now I want to read a poem about it. So you're like, oh, my God. you're either leaning back, ready for this amazing poem, or you're leaning forward, ready for this amazing poem. You're not in the same position. I mean, that's the kind of story that changes your whole life. Like, I've altered your existence now, repeating the story somebody else told. Like, you're all thinking about the really idiotic things you've done in your life, the danger you were in, the way in which all of us have survived some near-death experience in one form or another. So it's this universal fear, this very specific story that creates in us this tension. I mean, the power of a story. So she tells us in the room, there's like 20 of us in the room, we're all like, oh, God, now I want to read the poem. And she says, I'm approximating. The fog was foggy.
No. It was that?
That bad? Yeah. It was that bad, and it, and the thing is, the poem on its own, if you'd read it in a magazine or in a book, you probably would have went, oh. I mean, because she was good enough to where the poem was on its own would have been, you would have read it and thought, you know, hey, you know, that's like a seventh season episode of Modern Family. It's not a first season, not even a third season. It's a seventh season episode of Modern Family. Like, oh, I'll watch it. I'm not going to give it an Emmy, but I'll watch it. And first time in history anybody's ever used Modern Family as an analogy for poems. But when immediately juxtaposed with the story that inspired the poem, what just popped into my head now is it's like she gave us the buffalo hot wing of the story, followed by the celery stick of the poem.
Mm. That is so cruel.
Oh. And
my God.
I don't know. I'm trying to remember where I wasn't in Minneapolis, so I'm okay. But and it was years ago, 4 years ago. And so now moving that story into the Native American literary world. Native Americans are so awesome. If any of you know any of us, like, personally, you know that just sitting around a dinner table, most of them are just like me on stage. They just kill you all night long. I mean, they make you laugh and cry. We destroy you with our art. We're like walking art. Every Indian is an art installation. I mean, even the boring ones are more interesting than your best storytellers, white people. The best white storyteller you know isn't even as good as a random guy at the Indian Center. And it's like there's like 9 Garrison Keillors on my res. You know,
and
but the thing is, somewhere in
did everybody just get that image of Garrison 9 Garrison Keillors marooned on it? Never mind.
It's a new. It's his new show. Res Home Companion, and and every episode is him going, "Hey, I'm Garrison Keillor," and the Indians are who? I do a radio show out in Minneapolis.
And.
Do you know Conway Twitty? And that's as inside a joke as it gets. But
storytellers.
But the thing is, so somewhere in between the Indian who can just astonish you with their storytelling, with their direct connection to millennia, you know, at least 45,000 years of storytelling manifested in the Indian, you know, at Denny's. And the incongruity, the magical incongruity of 45,000 years of indigenous tradition bursting out over pancakes at Denny's at 3 a.m. Somewhere or another, all too often, the person who can do that loses that when they go to the page. And I see it all too often. I teach Native writers. I know a lot of Indians. Sometimes Indians pretend like, you know, I sit in a glass case somewhere. And then a white person, you know, knocks on the door and I come out to be the Indian for white people. Somebody the other day at an audience, how connected are you to white Indians? How connected are you really to Indians? And I say, well, I have sex with one of them.
Pretty connected.
Pretty regularly. Really regularly for being married 25 years. Like on a scale for a 25-year marriage, oh, we get it on. They didn't like that answer. But that's how connected I am. How many Indians? I have 4 in my house all the time. Every time I turn around, there's an Indian in front of me. But the thing is, I mean, even in the book, and I can even get back to the book with this answer. Non-natives treat me like I'm some anomaly sometimes. Like I'm some miraculous storytelling creature that emerged from a science experiment in a BIA laboratory in Washington, D.C. Like I'm some Frankenstein where some white bureaucrat dug into Walt Whitman's grave and pulled out Walt Whitman's rotting brain and pushed it into this little Indian hydrocephalic Res Boy's head.
Who thinks this?
And me. And it's an analogy, Carrie. But the idea that I'm somehow some kind of miracle of storytelling that's disconnected from all the amazing storytellers in my family, in my tribe, in the Native American world. I come from a very specific tribe, a very specific people, a very specific culture. I'm this way because of my grandma and my mom and dad and my siblings and my cousins and the Native American world in general, and having spent 50 years with Indians. When I sit down with these same people, like I can be like, it's dozens of times in my career, I'm just pounding, if you can't see this radio people, but I'm like dancing in my chair because I don't know how many times I've sat the night before some reading or event when I've sat with these amazing Indians, these awesome Indian people, and they've killed me all night long with their stories and poems about happiness and joy and sadness and depression. Just rip me open and put me back together. Just tore me down emotionally and reconstructed me, sometimes in the same sentence, the power and beauty of our people. Individually and collectively, you know, tribe to tribe. And then you go to the workshop the next day or you go to the reading, and this same native who told this same amazing, beautiful story about being born in a cranberry bog of all damn things. I mean, there are things in the Indian world I didn't know. I had no clue Indians were born in cranberry bogs. I didn't know that until my wife's mother was born in a cranberry bog. I didn't know this. And you know, I meet her. The first time I meet her, that's the first thing she says to me. My wife's mother, the first thing she said to me was, I was born in a cranberry bog. And as I say that, you know, as I'm processing that, that's an incredible first sentence of a novel. Why didn't one of you Ho-Chunks write that shit? So this is me lovingly challenging Native writers who are listening or who are here. They start reading or they in their workshop, and then it's so safe. It risks nothing. Or it reverts to safe ideas about us. Mm-hmm. And I understand why. We've been so exploited. We've been so colonized. We've been so stereotyped. We've been so vilified and romanticized and canonized. We've been so treated as anything other than human that to display our humanity is terrifying. But to make great art for anybody, you have to be willing in your art to be the same person you are when you're telling a story to people you feel safe with. You have to take those enormous risks. And there are two coming. I mean, poets do it, but there are two coming now. Tommy Orange has a novel coming out next year called There, There. Urban Indian novel, it's amazing. He's coming. Therese Mayotte has a memoir coming in February called Heartberries. It's astonishing. Two astonishing books that are coming. And as I look back at history, there was this massive energy created in the late 60s, early 70s, in the American Indian world, this sense of belonging and pride, this sense of a common purpose, Politically, the American Indian Movement came to power. Mm-hmm. Artistically, you had Scott Mamede and James Welch and Leslie Silko and Jerry Harjo and Simon Ortiz, Adrian C. Lewis, Linda Hogan, all this generation of amazing Native writers, Louise Erdrich, this amazing generation of writers came out of all that energy. And it's weird to say this, but I think the Dakota pipeline protests have created the same sort of energy that existed in the 1960s. And I think there is right now this free-floating energy in the Native world that Native artists can reach out and grab and put it in themselves. So I firmly believe there's another wave coming. And I think there is going to be another wave. Like, in the next 3-4 years, there's going to be like 20 Native writers who are going to come out with classics in the way Housemaid of Dawn and Fool's Crow and Winter in the Blood and The Beat Queen and Mean Spirit and Ceremony came in the 60s and 70s. I think there's another wave coming, and I'm really excited. But I'm saying this aloud to you. It's only going to work for you, Indians, if you're as funny and amazing and vulnerable on the page as you are around the kitchen table. Step away from the kitchen table, step up to your computer, and be the same person. And that's how it works. And I know when you're thinking, but then you do that, and then you end up having to write an open letter on Facebook about how wounded you are. And then you have to get in front of large crowds of people and talk about your pain and sorrow and sadness and grief. Yes, you do. And the thing I always say to students, and maybe this comes back to our argument, and maybe this is where we agree, maybe this is where you're right and I'm wrong, no matter who you are as a writer, no matter what your career does, whether you sell 10 million books or 4, there is one person who desperately needs you, at least one, who desperately needs your stories and poems, your nonfiction, your essay. I don't believe soulmates and romance. I don't. I believe in soulmates and literature. Somebody needs your book. And I say this to all of you, non-natives too. Somebody needs your story. It could even be another Indian. And I can finish the answer with this. 3 or 4 times this has happened, I'll tell you once. I was in a southwestern city, and a giant Indian dude was in the back row of the reading. And there's almost always a giant Indian dude in the back row of my readings. Sometimes they come angry. I've heard anger. Like one time a guy in Montana raised his hand in the middle of the reading and tried to heckle me. Hey! Hey! Heckle me with a Rez accent. Hey! What? As if I'm scared of you. Hilarious to watch Indian guys try to scare another Indian guy. I got cousins in prison, dude, just like you. I was in the treehouse with murderers. There is a story. That's in the memoir, too. But and he said, you're a genius. I said, well, I'm way above average, but I'm not a genius. Can't even trash talk me with your false compliments. I said, well, but why do you think I'm a genius? He said, because you figured out what white people want and you give it to them. And I said, yeah, that's what I was thinking when I was 19 years old. And I sat down in a creative writing class in Pullman, Washington, at Washington State University. I thought, you know the way to fame and fortune? free verse poetry about reservation Indians.
White people want that.
Yeah. Just a clamoring for that. There's an algorithm specifically designed for that. You know, it's Prince, Replacements, Husker Du, and Rez Indian Kid. No. Salmon Boy. No. It's like, did you take an Econ 101 class, Indian guy? Do you understand supply and demand? There was no demand. There's still no demand. I don't understand it either. Mm. And, but in this Arizona, Phoenix, this other big Indian guy, and I thought it was going to be one of those things again, where some big Indian guy was going to bully me or try to bully me. It's like, don't, it's like, come on. I mean, I have PTSD about Rez bullies, but I'm going to fight back now. It happened in Santa Fe recently where a dude all of a sudden started talking about how college ruins Indians. Oh. Yeah. And I look at him, what's your degree in? It's obviously ruined you. And I thought, do you tell 18-year-old kids that? Geez, education is the magic bullet. Anyway, big Indian guy in Arizona waited for the whole signing, you know. And the only people who wait for the whole signing are potential stalkers and Indian street fighters. Just, I'll be watching you later. And so it's all done. It's just me and the booksellers. And he comes walking up. And one of the things I didn't do in the book that I will, when I didn't, in my rush to write it, in my grief, I didn't write about the things I miss, the beautiful things. I didn't write enough about the beautiful things of the Rez I miss and of Indian people that I love and miss from my youth and that I love now. And the beautiful androgyny of Native men, even us straight guys, I miss the hair. I miss the high singing voices. I miss the easy tears. I miss the way we move. I love the way we move. Watching this giant Indian guy gliding toward me and all his indigenous androgynous glory. And you Indian people know what I mean. Like when you're watching a 55-year-old, 300-pound Indian guy war dance. And he's so beautiful and graceful. And the oxymoron of war dancing. It's amazing. So he war dances up to me. In the Herd Museum, right? Anthropology everywhere. And he walks up to me and he says, hey. And I say, hey, because we're Indians. He says, you know, I was homeless for a long time. And just wandering around and trying to figure out what I was going to do. Then I went to the Indian Center and this was back in the early 90s, and sat down there and saw this book sitting there. Had a yellow cover and saw there was a Indian on the cover of it and picked it up. I thought it was just going to be another one of those Indian books. I picked it up and started reading it, and it was about me. About how I grew up and how I felt growing up. So I read that book, and then I read all your other books, and I read everybody's books. And I got my GED. And I'm starting college in September.
Wow.
So that's the power of the art. And with this memoir, I'm getting more private letters, more private conversations. I'm hearing stories from friends that I didn't know. They're telling me things they haven't ever told me before, people I've known for decades. Vulnerability is contagious.
Sherman, thank you.
Thanks to our sponsors, Bremer Bank, Becker Furniture World, Hamline University, and Love Your Melon.